We are continuing on, and if you weren't here last week, we talked about the first chapter of Daniel is just sort of the intro. It's in Hebrew, and then chapters 2 through 7 are in this, they call it a chiastic structure, where they go A, B, C, and then they go C, B, A, and they work backwards, right? And sometimes they do that on a big scale in the Bible. Sometimes it's just little ones. Sometimes it's just A, B, B, A. But you'll see them repeat themselves a lot. And you start looking at it sometimes like, it seems like they're repeating themselves a lot. So we're doing a study as a family on Ruth. And it just mentioned it recently that Ruth 2, 1 to 3 is this little structure. And it comes in and it says that Ruth is a relative of Elimelech. And that they are also related to Boaz, and then Ruth tells Naomi to go and glean in his field, right? And then it says, so she went out and gleaned in the field that was owned by Boaz, and that is a relative of Elimelech, right? And it sort of works forward and goes back. You know, like sometimes you're like, okay, is that really that important, or does it really matter that much? But if you reread those three verses, in between the end of the last sentence, as you go A, B, C, and it finishes with this C, and then it goes C, B, A, is this one little half a sentence about Boaz, who is their redeemer, where it says, basically it's Ruth petitioning, Naomi petitioning Ruth, and she says, go into that field to see if he will show you grace. Right? So that's the peak of that little structure. So it's sort of building up to say, this is what I want you to do to see if this Redeemer is going to show you unmerited favor. Is he going to give you the grace you need? So she went out and did what was prescribed. Right? So saying ABC, you go do ABC and you'll get grace. So she went out and did CBA, and they do it in that structure to sort of emphasize, hey, this is why it's there. Right? So this is a bigger structure. If you have any doubt whether this sort of is intentional or sort of happened, if you notice as you read through Daniel, it's not in chronological order. So 7 happens well before 5, I think it is. I get it right? So the last vision is actually during Nebuchadnezzar's reign. So yeah, those chapters are actually out of order. So I don't think it's coincidental that they put them out of order and make this perfect structure as you're reading through it. So, that structure is, the first one, chapters 2 and 7, is this sort of list of nations and their visions that are either a statue and it goes through the nations from Babylon to the wrong one, whatever. And then the last one is sort of that same vision, but it's in animals, right? The next two sort of bookends are faithful servants that are being rescued. So it's Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and Daniel in the lion's den. And then it builds up to these 4 and 5 in the middle, which is the prideful kings of Babylon exalting themselves and being sort of personally challenged by God, right? And in the end, both of those are, the greatest kings of Babylon in that middle section end up learning that they are beholden to the Almighty God, right? They need to bend the knee, or they will be judged. And it's sort of, all of Daniel is leading to that, like, it's showing you at small levels personally, it's showing you big levels nationally, God is in charge, right? He is sovereign, as we were just discussing. Whether you like it or not, whether you fully understand it or not, and you're looking like, this is a time when Babylon is in charge, you know, Israelites are exiles, the whole thing has gone horribly, and yet the whole book is, yes, but I'm still sovereign. You're looking around saying, this is not good, this is not the way things are supposed to be, but don't worry, I am still sovereign. Whether you like it or not, whether you think this is the way things should be going or not, doesn't really matter. I'm still in charge, right? And that's that center of that book. So we're working after that section, that's 2 to 7, that's in Aramaic. It goes back to Hebrew into some other visions from Daniel at the end. So we're working through that sort of Aramaic section right now. And we did the center ones where God is talking to those kings personally. And now we're sort of stepping back chapters 3 and 6. So if you want to open your Bible, you are welcome to. It'll be Daniel chapter 3. Verse 1, King Nebuchadnezzar made a gold statue, and they describe it differently. Mine says 90 feet high and 9 feet wide. He set it up on the plain of Dura in the province of Babylon. Right? So, because we're jumping around, you don't notice this, but like literally the paragraph before this, Nebuchadnezzar is admitting to Daniel, your God is indeed the God of gods, the Lord of kings, the revealer of mysteries. That was just after this vision he had, and it's one of many situations where Nebuchadnezzar is brought face to face with God and admits sort of the need. But the whole point of it was this vision of a giant statue that he had, and the top of the statue was gold, right? And it was meant to represent Babylon, the top part. And then the statue continues into different metals and whatever, right? But you can imagine he's sort of looking at that, whoa, top of that statue is gold. That's kind of nice, right? That's my kingdom. It's going well. So, surprisingly enough, he goes off not too long after that and builds a giant statue in the middle of the plains of Babylon, and it's all gold, right? It's not changing to all these other different types. So, verse 2 is a long list of attendees. He sent word to assemble. This whole chapter does a ton of that repeating stuff. So we won't go through all of them, but King Nebuchadnezzar sent word to assemble the satraps, prefects, governors, advisors, treasurers, judges, magistrates, and all the rulers of the provinces to attend the dedication of the statue he had set up. Verse 3 basically lists all those same people and said, believe it or not, they all came. It was sort of an offer you can't refuse. They all show up. And if you find out why, they'll be thrown in a fiery furnace if they don't. So they all do come. And at the start of 4, it says, a herald loudly proclaimed, people of every nation and language. And it starts going into this discussion, right? But if you step back, big picture, not that I start everything in Genesis, but let's go back to Genesis and discuss this, right? In Genesis, there was this little story about the Tower of Babylon. Right? So all the men got together, they exalted themselves, built a tower up to the sky that reached all the way up, and they said, let's make a name for ourselves, right? So here you are, you go full circle in the Bible, basically, almost to the end of the story, and this man comes out, and he makes a statue to man, basically. That's all it tells you in the thing. It's a statue of a person. It doesn't even say he made it of himself. And most likely it's not, because he doesn't say that. He doesn't say it's a statue of me. He says, I just made this giant gold statue on the plains of Babylon that stretches up to the sky. And the consequences in the Tower of Babylon is God splits all our languages up and disperses us all over, right? So here's a man that says, hey, everybody, come back to the plain of Babylon, all you tongues, all you nations, and look at this tower up to the sky that I built. That's a big golden man. And come and worship it. Right? So you can't get more clear the parallels to say, hey, wait a second. This is probably not a good idea. This is what happens when man gets together and they worship themselves, right? So Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego are there. At the end of the previous chapter, Daniel is appointed in the temple, sort of to be in charge, and Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego are to go out into Babylon and sort of be in charge of stuff there, right? So they're out and about in Babylon. There is no word exactly what they do, but some other administrative busybodies, middle managers, bring them forward. So the type of men that like to work in a pack and not take responsibility for things sort of point them out and say, hey, by the way, king, these three people are not listening to your decree, right? Sort of a sidetrack, but that happens in the Daniel story, happens in Jesus' story, and I think in many ways it's happening today. A lot of what makes Babylon Babylon is these people that don't want to take responsibility for themselves, that are upset when people stand forward and stand for truth and stand for righteousness. And they like to operate without having to stand up themselves, right? And that's what happens in this. It's sort of these middlemen people that sort of say, hey, by the way, as a pack, we can all denounce what you say, but we're not really standing up for anything ourselves, if you know what I mean. That happens a lot in public discourse. Somebody that wants to stand up for truth and righteousness will stand up, and other people say, well, we all agree, and the experts agree, that that what she said is wrong. But they don't really pick apart what they're saying. They don't challenge what they're saying. They're just sort of these middlemen. And men who boldly stand out and stand up for what is right get attacked quite often. So there's a quote from C.S. Lewis that Heather and I were just sort of talking about this section of the book, and I looked it up, and it says, "We make men without chests," and if you read the whole book, it's The Abolition of Man, and he talks, I think it's The Abolition of Man, I'll double check, but I think it is, but he talks about how, and this is back a ways, he was talking about World War II, about how we don't prioritize courage and virtue anymore. And what he says is we're making men without chests. We're making men that are not growing up to stand up for what is right and be strong, right? And he's worried about this in the context of World War II. But he says, we make men without chests, and we expect from them virtue and enterprise. We laugh at honor and are shocked to find traitors in our midst. And that's one of my favorite quotes. I have it up in my classroom. It says, we laugh at honor, and we're shocked to find traitors in our midst. And it's so true. It's so painful at times. You know what I mean? If you raise a kid that's actually a good kid, honestly, do parents, other parents laugh at you and laugh at that kid? You know what I mean? If your kid is the typical Boy Scout that does what's right and whatever else, that's not a good thing. You know what I mean? You'll have parents, like some in here, yes, that will say, thank you. Sylvia does it. You're raising your kids right. Thank you, Sylvia. It's nice to hear that sometimes. But overall, in our culture, that's not something that's looked at as a good thing. You know what I mean? And then you're like, these kids grow up to do all these horrible things. You're like, oh, I can't believe it. I don't know where it came from. We don't prioritize virtue anymore at all. We don't prioritize good things. So Marie just had a little dance recital, and I was kind of worried. Because you can imagine what a dance recital is. Thankfully, we went. Her teacher's an older woman, and she's very classy. So the whole dance recital was pretty good, I have to admit. And it was actually a lot of fun to watch and everything else. But there's a few that have modern dance, and there was a couple of moves where you're sort of like, all right, that's a little bit risque. And it's sort of, you know what I mean? It wasn't great. But in the grand scheme, I was like, that was a really tame, and that was really good. But what upset me most about all of it was that those few risque moves would come out, and there was a not inconsequential section of the crowd that would be like, woohoo, yeah! And you're sort of like, you're cheering when a 10-year-old is actually sexualized in front of everybody. And the crowd is cheering like animals. I'm like, do you understand what you're doing? I'm like, it just blows my brain that that is what's going on in our country, in our world. That that's what's prioritized and what's looked at as right and good. And you're just sort of like, whoa, how can we be so far off track? So, back to the story. Verse 13 and 14, right? So, then in a furious rage, Nebuchadnezzar gave orders to bring in Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. So these men were brought before the king. Nebuchadnezzar asked them, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, is it true you don't serve my gods or worship the gold statue I have set up? Right? Now remember, at the end of the last chapter, your God is indeed the God of gods, Lord of kings. And then he builds this statue and he's like, is it true you guys are not worshiping my statue? Surprisingly enough, it is true, right? So, continues on in verse 15. Now if you're ready, when you hear the sound of the horn, and you might have different instruments, the words are kind of unclear. The horn, the flute, the zither, the lyre, the harp, the drum, and every kind of music, fall down and worship the statue I made. If you don't worship it, you will be immediately thrown into a furnace of blazing fire. Right? And here is the greatest line. So that's actually, if you look at that line and you read back up above, that's actually word for word what's on the previous section where it says this is what's going to happen, right? So it's sort of that same format. He repeats exactly everything, but he throws in one little extra line. And that lets you know this line should be highlighted, right? This is an extra he threw in rather than just repeat it word for word. When they throw in the extras, that's like a clue. And who is the God who can rescue you from my power? Right? So that is a challenge, if I ever heard one. Right? He clearly didn't learn his lesson last time. He clearly doesn't learn it this time, to be honest with you, because you know in the next chapter he ends up eating grass like a donkey. because he's walking on his palace saying, isn't this the Babylon that I built? It's so awesome, right? So you know he's not going to learn his lesson again. And you sort of, sometimes you look at this and you read through the Old Testament and you're like, it's so silly. It's like, are you kidding me? Like, you see this, and then 5 minutes later, you walk out, and you ignore God, and you move on, right? But, do you think you're better than Nebuchadnezzar? Right? So we were just talking to let go and let God, sort of, kind of the phrase, kind of like that, saying he's sovereign, right? You have to sort of understand that he's in charge and all of that. So you say that phrase once, and peace like a river for the rest of your life. Correct? You don't put it on your wall. You don't repeat it to your friends all the time. You don't continuously say, God is in control. God is in control. I know he is. Somewhere he's in control, right? You continuously have to repeat that to yourself. You never sort of fall into that, right? So it's also to note, especially the Old Testament, and this book in particular as well, it's like a greatest hits. Right? So it's the greatest hits of all the things most of the time that these people are doing wrong. Sometimes could be separated by years. So if someone was writing a greatest hit story of your life with your greatest valleys, which hopefully God redeemed you from, you'd probably look like a dope, right? You had this really bad valley, God saves you, and then the next time you're losing faith? Are you kidding me? What's wrong with you, right? But it happens to all of us, doesn't it? So it's our plea to have some pity on these people in the Old Testament. For that matter, for your fellow man. So it's easy to write off all those people that are making poor choices. We just talked about that. You know, if they're falling in drugs or sexual sin or homosexuality. We just said, like, we love the redeemed stories, but sometimes we don't always love those that need redeeming the way that we're supposed to, so that they can become those redeemed stories, right? Even liberals, even people that have different political views than you, gotta love those people, right? Because they may be at the bottom of that. They may be the people that are coming back and having those redeemed stories, like a Satanist. We had one at the River Rock concert, and the guy was a crystal meth addict and a Satanist. And he was up on stage telling how God saved his life. That's like a double whammy of wow. How do you come back from that, right? But if you meet him when he's in that trough, just gotta understand. So, all right. Hopefully, everybody knows the rest of the story. We'll go a little bit quick. So, Nebuchadnezzar says, fire up that furnace 7 times hotter. 7 is a sign of completeness, so he's sort of saying, set it as hot as that's going to go, because these people are going to get tossed in, right? The men that are throwing them into the furnace, it gets so hot, they end up catching on fire and dying. It's pretty frightening, right? And he throws them in, and inside the fire, a fourth figure appears. The wording is like a son of the gods, but it's Elohim, so you can't interpret it son of God. Some people believe that's a theophany. Some people believe it's Jesus himself that's appearing there, and some it's an angel. To a certain extent, in our case, it's not the priority of this chapter, but somehow a godly being is in that furnace with them. Nebuchadnezzar sees the whole thing and says, whoa, wait a second. There's a fourth person in there. They bring them out, no hair is singed, they don't even smell like smoke, right? But God didn't protect them really from the consequences of their actions. They got thrown into the furnace, right? God was just with them when they went into those trials, right? He didn't stop them before. So if you're Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, you're getting tied up, right? And, wait a second. I missed a piece. Oh, I did. Sorry. In verse 17 and 18, I was just about to say the best line. I skipped the best line in the whole book. Verse 17 and 18, after Shadrach sets them up, they say their only words in all of Daniel. If the God we serve exists, then he can rescue us from the furnace of blazing fire. And he can rescue us from the power of you, the king. Remember, God, he said, who's a God that can rescue you from my power? But even if he does not rescue us, we want you, as king, to know that we will not serve your gods or worship the gold statue you set up. Right? Those are pretty classy words. So, my God is strong enough to save me from this, but even if that doesn't happen, he's still God and he's still sovereign. Even if we don't like the actions today, tomorrow, or whatever, that doesn't mean he's not sovereign and I'm not going to do what's right anyway. Right? So, I know there's two songs. One is Mercy Me and one's Dave Pettigrew, and I forget which one is which, but the name of it is Even If Not. And it basically says, and both of them were written about people who were battling sicknesses, and they're saying, God, I know you can heal this person, but even if not, I'm still going to worship you. Right?
Mercy.
Is that Mercy Means? Okay, yeah. I know Dave has one that's very similar,
yeah.
But I forget which one's which. So yes, even if not is that line, right? Jesus says that even when he's about to go to the cross, you know, take this cup from me, but bottom line is thy will be done, right? You need to do what you need to do, and I need to just understand that you're sovereign and that you have a plan for all of this, right? So I hope I have words like that to be remembered by someday. So they get thrown into the fire. And that's what I was just about to say. You can imagine if they're on the doorstep, you get tied up. You're just about to be thrown into the super hot furnace. Presumably, you're at the stage where you're thinking, this must be the even if not section of the story. Because I just got pinned down, tied up, and I'm getting thrown into a furnace. Right? But they didn't renounce God at that point. They didn't say, they were going along with even if not. Right? That's the case. And God was with them through their trials. So that is a wonderful situation, wonderful witness. So speaking of witness, after all this happens, verse 28 and 29, Nebuchadnezzar exclaimed, "Praise to the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who sent his angel and rescued his servants who trusted in him. They violated the king's command and risked their lives rather than serve or worship any god except their own." Right? Pretty cool admission. So he is still Nebuchadnezzar. He's got some anger issues. "Therefore, I issue a decree that anyone of any people, nation, or language who says anything offensive against the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego will be torn limb from limb and his house will be made a garbage dump. For there is no other God who's able to deliver like this." So, still got some anger issues, but he did, at least, in that moment, understand, hey, wait a second, God is in charge even over me. He's sovereign over me. And that story leads right into the story where he ends up being challenged. He has his own vision. And is challenged to recognize God as king and ruler, and he does. And God actually restores him to his kingdom. Right? So, that is one story on the bookend of that. It goes in, talks about the king, and comes out in chapter 6, where Darius is king over Babylon. Okay. Side note, Darius is actually an honorific. It means the royal one. So there are some people at dispute. Most people believe that Cyrus the Great himself. Some people think it might be a governor ruling on his behalf. But generally, most people believe that's Cyrus, even though he's referred to as Darius because that's a term, royal one. So at the beginning of that, Daniel, at the age of 80-something, gets placed as one of the top men in Babylon, one of the top three, and in the beginning of that chapter, it sort of explains he's probably going to end up as the top man in all of Babylon, basically ruling on behalf of the king for the most part, which is pretty crazy, right? So he is an Israelite. He remained faithful all the way through, still does in the heart of Babylon, and the king still recognizes that, hey, by the way, this person is competent. He's working on behalf of our nation. He's making good decisions. And I think I'm going to put him in charge, right? And that's not the only time that happens to loyal, faithful Christians. But here come those faceless middlemen. So in verses 4 and 5, make sure I'm right one. Yes. So we're in chapter 6, verse 4 and 5. The administrators and satraps, therefore, kept trying to find a charge against Daniel regarding the kingdom. They could find no charge of corruption, for he was trustworthy, and no negligence or corruption was found in him. Then these men said, "We will never find any charge against Daniel unless we find something against him concerning the law of his God." Right? So Daniel was above reproach, so they target his faith. Right? That is, depending on your age and situation, happening to Christians now. It will be happening more. So some of you are older and more in retirement, not worried about it, but professing a view on traditional marriage is frowned upon in the public world, if you didn't know that. In most large workplaces, it's sacrosanct to say that marriage should be between a man and a woman. So it's a little challenging. But most of you know the story. I'm not going to read all of it. I'm just going to sort of talk about the lessons, hopefully. It's Daniel and the lion's den. So many of you, I assume, have heard this story and know it, right? So the busybodies get a law passed that says you cannot pray to anyone other than the king for a month. If not, you'll get thrown in the lion's den. So Daniel, there's actually a prayer when the temple is being consecrated that Solomon does, and he's talking about hopefully the nation will be long in here, but he actually puts in his prayer, but even if it gets defeated and things go horribly and you get dragged off and you end up as an exile somewhere, I pray that when our Hebrews, our Israelites do that they will pray facing Jerusalem and that God will hear their prayer. Right? So Daniel, as the exile in Jerusalem, prays three times a day facing prays three times a day facing Jerusalem, hoping that God will hear his prayer. Right? So he's being faithful and asking. That's in 1 Kings 8:48, if you'd like to look those things up yourself. So he gets turned in, and he is not saved from the lion's den. He is forced into the lion's den, but there is an angel in the lion's den with him, right? And he comes out, and in verse 23, the king was overjoyed and gave orders to take Daniel out of the den. When Daniel was brought up from the den, he was found to be unharmed, for he trusted in God, right? So the king, if you don't remember the story, actually didn't want him to get thrown in. He was quite upset about the whole thing. It's a unique fact in Babylon. It was trying to put sort of some constraints on kingly rule that even the king had to follow his own laws, right? So if he made that law, he had to stick by it. So he was upset that he made that law, that he was tricked into it because he didn't want Daniel to end up in the lion's den. So he was quite excited when he came out. So the anger problems of kings seem to continue. Verse 24, the king then gave the command, and those men who had maliciously accused Daniel were brought and thrown into the lion's den. They and their children and their wives. And they had not reached the bottom of the den before the lions overpowered them and crushed their bones. So if you asked Daniel, he probably would not have wanted that to happen, is my guess. He might not have even wanted to be redeemed himself if he knew that was what was going to happen. But Daniel did what was right. And God sorts the consequence. That's my favorite saying for my kids, right? Do what's right and let God sort the consequences, right? Don't get caught up in worrying about all that stuff because you can be spun in circles about it. Just do what's right. God will figure the rest of that out, right? So Daniel did, and in verse 26, the exact same sentence, I issue a decree that in all my royal dominion, the people must tremble in fear before the God of Daniel. For he is the living God, and he endures forever, and his kingdom will never be destroyed. His dominion has no end. He rescues and delivers. He performs signs and wonders in the heavens and on the earth. For he has rescued Daniel from the power of the lions. Right, so that's the second king in this book that ends up in that same place, bowing the knee and saying, all right, I got to admit it, God is sovereign. So, got the two stories that are bookending this, right? Both stories, they are faithful God followers that are exiles. They stay faithful before the event, right? Living up to that, and they're faithful during the story, right? And stay faithful to God. They were blessed before that event. They were blessed even more after the event. Both of them were sort of basically given honorific and titles and all of those types of things. The middlemen and busybodies turn them over, even though the kings are not necessarily the ones looking for that. They both face the consequences for their actions. God was with them through those consequences. And therefore, both of the kings had to acknowledge God as sovereign, right? So they're very, very similar stories, if you haven't noticed. That whole pattern plays out almost an exact mirror image going through it, right? So a couple of lessons that at least I took away, or I would like to sort of point out. First off is we all need to find our identity in God. Our society at large talks about identities a lot. And we all need to focus on our identity. It comes from God and is given by God, right? We're made in His image. We must remain faithful. Even as our nation and other places might fall away from God, we need to continue to put His kingdom first, right? You just need to focus on that every day, all the time, right? Now, once you've got that sorted, and you understand that His kingdom is first and you belong to that, two is all of these people participated as citizens, right? And they were pretty good citizens. And they were blessed, and they blessed many others, I'm sure, because they were honest and truthful and straightforward and ruled to the best of their ability when they were given those opportunities, right? And they were rewarded for that, right? So I don't think there's anyone in here that looks back and says, wow, it's too bad that all our founding fathers were such godly men. You know, it's just terrible that that happened, right? So it's wonderful to have godly men in positions of influence. So be those people, right? That's not a bad thing to do that. Third one is do what is right in God's eyes. I think the last sermon that we were in, I mentioned that constant refrain in Judges that the people did what was right in their own eyes. And it never went well for them when they did such things, right? So do what is right in God's eyes. In these stories, they were very peaceful and even to a certain extent polite sometimes. Shadrach and Meshach were pretty polite in the grand scheme for the situation they were in. They're sort of like, sorry, sir. I know you went through a lot of trouble to build that gold statue and all, but I can't bow down and worship, you understand, because I got my God thing going on. It just doesn't work out for me. But you need to start thinking of these things, doing right, planning ahead and saying, when are these situations going to come up in my life? I think that helps if you start thinking these things through in advance, right? It says that we should have a reason for our hope that is within us, right? And you're going to end up in more situations and more situations, sometimes talking to friends, family that may have gone astray, and you're going to have viewpoints that are different than the world, that are different than them. When are you going to stand up for that? When are you going to not? It's sometimes a challenge. If you remember last week, I think it was, I mentioned that, you know, we can talk about these principles, we can talk about frameworks, and say, this is how God lays some stuff out, here's some facts, here's some stories, some examples. It's never quite a magic wand. He never says, in your unique situation in 2022, this is what you should be doing right here, right? It's never a magic wand, but at least you can start thinking through these things in that way. Right? So one of the things for me, a couple of things that have come up in society that you're thinking about, right? All of us have had to discuss this or looked at it in the last couple of years. One is masks, right? So there are people that believe that that is a step towards authoritarianism. Sooner or later, you've got to step in and say, hey, I'm just not going to do it. I'm going to push back. There are other people that say in certain situations you shouldn't. There are other people that say you are not caring for your neighbor when you're wearing a mask, right? There's another thing, for instance, where you weren't allowed to worship in church, right? And there were some churches that pushed back on that, most notably John MacArthur in California, where they just said, I don't care what the law is, we're going to have church anyway, right? This is what we're going to do. And in my mind, something that's helped me is that first problem is a U.S. citizen problem. Is that moving us into authoritarianism? You can certainly discuss that as a citizen. You can make those decisions. That's great. But I don't necessarily clearly see that as a godly issue. That doesn't mean it's not good. Doesn't mean it's not important. Doesn't mean you don't have to make a stand. You've got a million things you've got to make a stand on somewhere, right? But in my mind, it helped me to be a little bit easier to say, all right, that's a situation where we're discussing that set as a citizen, right? That's something we participate as citizens. We're hopefully glad to be U.S. citizens and glad to be here. I want to work on that. And that distinction in my brain helps me. Whereas when it says you can't worship, right? You can argue, and some people discuss whether John should have had church, whatever else, that's fine. But what I will say is once he has the conviction that the government has said they shouldn't worship and that's in contradiction to what God would want, he does not have a choice but to not follow the laws of this nation, right? Once he is convicted that this is the case, I have a choice between God's kingdom and my kingdom here on earth or some kingdom that I am pledging allegiance to, he didn't have a choice at that point, right? So I respect him for that. And there were a lot of pastors in Canada that had similar type of situations, right? So, and it's not to say any of those decisions were right or wrong. I'm just trying to give you some frameworks to sort of think about it and say, there are times when we're citizens. That's not a bad thing. It's wonderful, right? America's a great country. Like I said last time, we can't put our hope in America, but we can hope for America. We can hope for revival. We can hope for, you know, some amazing changes and some great things. And there's nothing wrong with being patriotic. But at the same time, there are times when we have to put the kingdom of God first.
Amen.
Right? And we have to understand that there is a distinction between the two. Doesn't mean it's wrong to have a patriotic views or to have decisions that you make in that framework. It just means make sure you make a clear line between the two. Sometimes people get them mushied up, I think, a little bit. So, if step three was do what is right in God's eyes, step four is let God sort the consequences, right? You're not going to avoid trials in this life one way or the other. So getting caught up in what's going to happen if you make this decision, what people will think, what someone else will happen, what are the ramifications, I honestly don't think you should weigh those up. I think if there's a right answer and God tells you that in your heart that's a right answer, then you just do it. Just don't think about what's going to happen after the fact, because God will work it out for you in one way, shape, or form. How many people have you talked to that have either walked away from a job or lost a job or something horrible has happened, and like literally the next day or the next week, something has happened to help sort that situation for them, right? And they all say, well, God was just waiting for me to have faith in him and understand that he's sovereign and do what is right. So just don't get caught in those consequences. Do what is right. And God will sort through that, because you're not going to avoid those trials. Last week we mentioned Job, obviously, had lots of consequences in his life. And in the end of the book, it just sort of says, and you know, God redeemed him and sort of made it all good. And he had 50,000 goats and whatever, camels and this and that. And he had a bunch of kids and all that type of stuff, right? So I'm presuming, although it doesn't say literally, that took quite a while for that to happen, right? He probably didn't apparate him 10,000 goats in a field one day. It took time for him, but God blessed him in his ventures and what he was doing, and he eventually worked his way back up to having blessings. He eventually worked his way to having a family again, right? And got back there. So it jumps to the end of the story there, but that took a long time, right? If Job was 40 when this first thing happened, he was probably 70 by the time the end of that story comes about and says, oh yes, he's got all these kids and grandkids and he's got farms and whatever again, right? So that could take a long time. Or you could literally be on that furnace door and tomorrow God is going to sort all these consequences for you in something miraculous, right? And you don't know. You don't know if you're Job and you're looking at this and, wow, this is going to be a long recovery for me back to where God has redeemed me the way I should be. And it could be a miracle tomorrow, right? But either way, you remain faithful to God and understand that he's sovereign and that he has a path for you to work you through that.
That's right.
So, as I was finishing this off, my wife was playing music in the background, and it's one of my favorite songs, not actually all that well known, called Always, and the chorus is, "Oh my God, you will not delay, my refuge and strength always. I will not fear, your promise is true, my God will come through always." So, in prayer, God, we thank you for your word. We thank you for all the lessons and wisdom you give us in this book, but even more so for your redemption from slavery, sin, death, from this crazy world of Babylon. Please help us to always have faith because your promises are true, and just rest in the assurance that you always work things out for your good in particular. But if we are faithful servants of you, that means it's for our good as well. So just give us peace with that and wisdom to traverse these days. In Jesus' name, amen.
Amen.
Now, John, what are satraps?
Satraps, they go.